spent fuel pools, had debris in them after the hydrogen explosions, more debris, but they never had the massive leak. The problem was, if you're in the control room or in the emergency support facility on site, whatever kind of it's called, you're dealing with a reactor, you don't want to have to worry about what's going on behind your back in the spent fuel pool. So we recommended to NRC, and they agreed in their reviews as well, that we needed to improve our ability to know the level of the water in spent fuel pool so we would know when to inject more water into the pool in these remote manners, as I said. We have also working on the ability to improve the venting of the containment to a similar design plant. We are conducting seismic reviews, flooding reviews, reviews for other hazards. A whole variety of improvements are being made, and in the interest of time, we'll just leave the rest of this detailed questions.
Sure. Thank you. Dave,
Good afternoon. As Stephen indicated, and you may know, the March 11th, 2011 accident at Fukushima Daiichi was a string together of a lot of things that went wrong. The earthquake took away the normal supply of power to the plant. The tsunami waters that arrived about 45 minutes later flooded the basement where all the emergency diesel generators for units 1 through 4 were located, disabling them, taking away the backup power, and plunging the plant into, as Steve indicated, a station blackout. The plant was designed for station blackout. Unfortunately, that design was limited, and it provided 8 hours worth of batteries for a station blackout that lasted longer than 8 days. There was a backup to that as well, which was an array of diesel pumps, diesel engines that could be used to move water, either seawater or fresh water, in to cool the reactor. But the workers weren't well trained to use that. In addition, they had difficulty dealing with too much pressure inside the reactor vessel. The valves, the vent valves that needed to open to do that, were designed really to work needed power. The accident most likely to challenge them and need them is a loss of power, so they were there for an accident that made them unable to work, not limited value. Had any one of those things been a success instead of a failure, we wouldn't be here today talking about Fukushima. It took a lot of things going wrong for Fukushima to occur. These aren't house of cards where one thing can cause disaster. It takes a lot of bad things to cause a disaster. After Fukushima, the NRC formed a near-term task force to look at that accident and extract lessons learnable from it that could be applied to reducing the vulnerabilities at our plants. That task force recommended more than 30 measures to address vulnerabilities here. Even if all of those measures were fully and effectively implemented, all it will do is prevent a Fukushima-style accident from affecting our plants. We think the NRC's goal should be higher than no more Fukushimas. We think the NRC's proper goal should be no more Fort Calhouns. Fort Calhoun shut down about a month after Fukushima in April of 2011 and remained shut down for 30 months until December of 2013, 30 months. During that time, an army of workers dealt with literally dozens of safety problems, many of which had been there for the entire 30 years that the plant operated. And Fukushima and Fort Calhoun is not the only plant to have been shut down for longer than a year to fix a whole bunch of safety problems. It's the 52nd time that a U.S. reactor has been shut down for longer than a year. How often do these year-plus outages occur? NRC's information digest, which is on the back, shows the first reactor began operating in 1957, 57 years ago. 52 year-plus outages in 57 years is one outage, year-plus outage, every 57 weeks. There were 42 of those reactors that had 2 year-plus outages. There are only 132 reactors licensed to operate by the NRC and its predecessor, the Atomic Energy Commission. 42 reactors with year-plus outages out of a universe of 132 is a 32% chance of a reactor encountering a year-plus outage. All told, the reactors that have operated in the United States, power reactors that have operated in the United States, have accumulated about 3,000 reactor years of experience. During that time, there's been 138 years they spent in year-plus outages. So roughly 4.6% of the lifetime is mired in a year-plus outage fixing multiple safety issues The point is, if we can stop, have, or at least slow down the rate, if we can't stop the doggone thing, slow down the rate of year-plus outages. Don't allow problems to accumulate, sweep them under the rug until you just literally can't cross the floor anymore. We shouldn't have to wait that long before we step in and stop this problem. By doing so, these are pre-existing failures, which makes it easier for a disaster or a challenge to complete the steps and cause disaster. Instead of Fort Calhoun, instead of having a whole bunch of things between it and disaster, decades of operating with safety problems, it shortened the list, making it easier for vulnerability to cause disaster at one of our plants. So what we need to do is stop or slow down the year-plus outages. If we do that by eliminating pre-existing failures, we'll protect against the financial disasters. Forgot to mention that those 52 year-plus outages collectively have a cost of about $82 billion in 2005 dollars. That's a lot of money. You wouldn't need loan guarantees for new reactors if they just put that into a fund and paid for their own reactors instead of having us back them up. So we need to stop year-plus outages. In doing so, we went back and looked at two of the last 2 year plus outages, Davis-Besse 2002 to 2004, Fort Calhoun from 2011-2013. If you look at the NRC scorecards for those two plants, the NRC thought that Davis-Besse was the best performing plant in Region 3. Turned out it was the worst plant in the country. Anytime your rating system can't distinguish the best from the worst, you have some work to do. Fort Calhoun was a little bit better, but they were close to the most significant findings. The red, yellows, and whites in the NRC's four color-coded systems were found at Davis-Besse and were found at Fort Calhoun after the plant shut down. They had existed for decades before then, but they weren't found until after the plant shut down. Why? Do the inspectors can't see things until when a plant's running? Or things that are found when the plant's running, are they dismissed, downplayed, swept away because plant's running must be okay? There's something fundamentally wrong with how we oversee, and we being the nuclear industry, because INPO's out there allegedly protecting against unsafe reactors, and the NRC, which is the public's guardian. 52 year-plus outages, most of them occurring under INPO's watch, is not a success story by any stretch of the imagination. If we don't stop the problems that lead to year-plus outages, we're not going to have a year-plus outage. We're going to have an American Fukushima. Those pre-existing problems lining up when some challenge occurs to exploit them to cause a disaster in this country. So the goal should be no more Fort Calhouns. That will also protect against Fukushimas and will protect against the financial meltdowns that keep occurring every 57 weeks. Thank you.
Okay. I'll probably direct some questions regarding some of his comments to a couple of you here on the panel. Hannah, please.
My name is Hannah Northey. I'm a reporter with E&E Publishing Greenwire in Washington, D.C. And to give a little context, I've been covering the nuclear industry since February 2011, along with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and energy policy on Capitol Hill. So I started covering this issue a month before Fukushima hit, so it was a steep learning curve. I'm going to just talk a little bit about my experience in Japan and what I saw as some risks in the government when it comes to the restart. So for the purposes of this panel, what I thought was an interesting takeaway message, when I was in Tokyo, I interviewed Tokyo University professor Dr. Kurokawa, and he led the government's first independent commission into the Fukushima accident. When I went to meet with him, he told me Japan had not learned the lessons from the accident, that no one from TEPCO or from the government had really stepped up to take responsibility for this accident. He was very critical of the media. He said that they weren't asking the right questions. And this is 3.5 years after the accident occurred. So it was a pretty powerful point that he made. Now, as you know, Japan has shut down their 48 reactors after the accident, and the Abe administration has made a point in their energy plan that they want to restart these units. Now, kind of the question that comes to mind is what happened after these reactors were shut down. you know, one of the really kind of untold stories is about energy efficiency, and it's called Setsudan in Japan. And they have programs, they're kind of like cool biz, and you can actually buy clothes to save the efficient, you know, they're cooler clothes for your office, you know, so it's a culture of saving energy there, so that was a very important part. As well, you can tell from EIA numbers, it's clear that coal imports went up, LNG imports went up, and oil, which is more costly, is actually being shaved away a bit in the country. But still, it's a matter of an increase for fossil fuel imports, and that's going to play into climate debates coming into the future. You can leave that for Q&A. But so far, you know, a lot of the question is, well, when will these plants restart? And on one point, you have the Abe administration really pushing to restart these plants. They are backed by Kidanrin, which is kind of like our Chamber of Commerce, our business industry. On the other hand, the large majority of the Japanese public has, you know, their skepticism about nuclear power. And there are local politics that are going to come into play here. And to wrap my hands around that story, I focused on the Kashiwazaki Kariwa nuclear plant. That plant is on the western side of Japan, on the Sea of Japan. And it's a massive plant. You actually drive to the site, and over one hill you can see four reactors. You walk over on the other side and you see three more. So it's a monster of a plant. And this facility was interesting, one, because TEPCO owns it. Two, I interviewed the governor of Niigata, and he's very opposed to this plant restarting. He said, you know, TEPCO either needs to file for bankruptcy and go through a reshuffling like General Motors, or they need to give up the operation of this plant. He, however, is kind of seen as an outlier, a very outspoken politician. But that kind of puts a point on, in Japan, you have the Nuclear Regulatory Authority. They sign off on the safety of these plants. But then there's this, from what sources tell me and from what I can understand, is a fuzzy relationship with the local community, the prefecture, the governor. They have to sign off on the restart of the plant as well. So whether there's leveraging there, whether there are politics there, it's unclear, although the sentiment is that the government probably will restart some of these reactors. I personally think it's kind of unclear. What I also did see at the Kashiwazaki Kariwa plant is, you know, these operators, Japan's main utilities, are doing a lot of safety upgrades. They're trying to reassure a skeptic public. One thing that was very impressive at that, impressed me at the plant was this 15-meter seawall. Now, there, the highest, it was just, I think a couple weeks ago, it's 3.4 meters is what the expected max tsunami is there if you have this massive seawall. And they'll tell you that they built this seawall based on what happened at Fukushima. Yeah, they showed me watertight doors, the safety equipment higher up elevation. So they're really trying to show you that this plant is safe, it can be restarted. But it's also central to TEPCO's business plan. So, you know, it's in their interest to restart that plant. Now, while I was in Japan, I also had the opportunity to go into the 12-mile evacuation zone around the plant. One of the towns there we went to was called Tamioka Town. And, you know, it's been 3.5 years. And you drive into this town and you see blasted out storefronts that used to be homes and businesses, overturned cars, rusted, weeds growing up through them. People can only go there for a certain number of hours because there is radiation concern. And, you know, it's an ongoing crisis there. It hasn't changed. It looks like a town frozen in time. And further away, we went to Iwaki City, and I had the chance to interview evacuees. They're still living in temporary housing, which kind of look like small wooden trailers with on-ramps. There are over 100,000 people still living in these shelters. And one man who I talked to really kind of struck me. His name was Atsushi Fuda. He was in his 70s. He was living in this kind of cramped quarters with his wife, and he had been there for years. It was touching because he said, I don't have a community here. I don't have the same people. I miss my homeboys back in Hirono, where we went fishing and had a beer. And he just couldn't go back to his hometown because of radiation concerns and lagging infrastructure. So just to kind of wrap it up, those are the images that I saw when I went to Japan. And I think the restart is unclear at this point.
Thank you. Cynthia.
Good afternoon. I'm Cindy Peterson. I'm the regional administrator for our Chicago office of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And I, too, had an opportunity to go to Japan earlier this year, and it's a very striking example of what can happen when things aren't adequately controlled. I did want to spend a minute, though, talking about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's role. This panel is focused on the outlook of nuclear power post-Fukushima, and I wanted to put in context what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does. We fulfill an independent regulatory role given to us by Congress to do no more and no less than that. And our mission is to license and regulate the civilian use of radioactive materials, which includes nuclear power plants. And we do that to protect the public health and safety, promote the common defense and security, and to protect the environment. Our role is not to speculate on the nuclear future. It's not to try to influence it one way or the other. Our responsibility is singularly focused on safety. And if a facility is going to use radioactive material, it must be done safely. Otherwise, we won't allow it to operate at all. Now, the fundamental responsibility for safety is that of the licensees or those that operate the plants. But we play a very important role to independently oversee what they do. I think that the importance of the NRC's mission really came home to me in very vivid terms when I did go to Japan this past February. As I rode through the same areas that Hannah did that were evacuated, and I had the opportunity to go to the Daiichi site as well as Daimien, the KK site as well. But it's so striking that these individuals had to leave their homes that may never be able to return or not for years. And then you go to the plant, you see the physical destruction. It really reinforces that need to make sure it doesn't happen here or anywhere else in the world. And with that context, I wanted to tell you a number of the things that we have done post-Fukushima. On the day of the tsunami and the earthquake, March 11, 2011, we too instituted our emergency response organization and staffed our emergency response center 24/7. It lasted for months. But the focus that we initially had was, would the tsunami have impact on any of the U.S. facilities, either power plants or radioactive material users there in the Pacific, either the West Coast or the territories, Alaska, Hawaii? And we concluded the tsunami would not have a significant impact on those. So that was our first interest. But very quickly and continually, we interfaced with our Japanese counterparts. And on the same day of the tsunami, we did put a couple of people on the plane to head over to the U.S. Embassy to help there, and they were soon thereafter supplemented with a team of experts that provided support for months. During this time, we always were asking ourselves, is there an immediate impact on the U.S. facilities? Do we need to do something different? We're learning as we're getting information. And some of the information was slow in coming. We struggled with getting information as well. But within 3 months of, 3.5 months probably technically, we did have the near-term task force report issued, which was the reporting of an expert group of people who were looking at those early lessons learned from Fukushima. And the conclusion there was no imminent risk for the operation of the U.S. facilities, but there were things to be learned and actions to be taken. And I wanted to briefly talk with you about a few of those. If you picked up a sheet that looked like this on the back table, if not, please pick one out on your way out. I'm going to be talking to a few of the things that are on here. This feel free to get one now, that might help. What it is a snapshot of the highest priority, the top tier lessons learned from the Fukushima response. And so I'm going to touch on a number of those as to what's happening currently here in the U.S. You heard mentioned earlier of the mitigating strategies. We implemented an order requiring actions to be taken at the U.S. Fleet to do a number of things, but focused on ensuring containment integrity, cooling of the reactor core, and cooling of the spent fuel pool, and those to be done in three stages. Installed equipment for the first number of hours to ensure the installed equipment would continue those functions. Within hours to be supplemented by on-site equipment to provide those same functions, and then to receive off-site support from either other facilities or from one of the two national response centers, that are one being located in Memphis, one being in the Phoenix area. These are in various stages of implementation. Implementation dates are staggered because some of the work has to be done during outages for various modifications to equipment and systems, and others are because of limitations in resources, both on our side, there's only so much review work we can do at a time, as well as on availability and equipment. I did have an opportunity recently to go to the Memphis Center and see firsthand the portable equipment that is being relied upon for this strategy, and it's an impressive set of equipment that should serve those functions. We also are looking at spent fuel pools. You heard that mentioned earlier. That was a large distraction for all organizations after the accident, and we are requiring level instrumentation. Briefly, it's at the normal level, a reduced level that still allows people to work in the vicinity of the spent fuel pool, and then a level basically at the top of the fuel, meaning one must add water immediately. Other things that are happening, and you'll see listed on the chart, are various reevaluations in the flooding and in the seismic area. And as you all know, science continues to evolve. We get better science with time, and we have asked the licensees to do a review of what that new information is and new modeling, such that it can be brought up to date and see if there are gaps between what currently exists and what needs to be. Just briefly, another area is in emergency response in the areas of communications and staffing. Our structure had been looking at a single reactor event, even at a multiple reactor site. We now are expecting licensees to be able to combat multiple units affected at the same time, which requires additional staffing. We've also identified the necessity for better and improved communications to ensure the ability to communicate on-site as well as externally. And then we've already modernized what we call an emergency response data system, which is our data link. Oh, I'm going long. Getting the sign. Our emergency response data link. I look forward to your questions. I've got a lot more I could talk with you about. The NRC has done a lot in the last 3.5 years. You may think, boy, that seems like a long time. But we've studied the situation, we've developed recommendations, we're getting licensees to take action. And we also recently had an international body of experts come in and look at our program. That's called the International Regulatory Response Review. And they have said, actually gave us very positive remarks about the status, and I'll actually just quote, "The NRC has acted promptly and effectively after the TEPCO Fukushima Daiichi accident in interests of public health and safety." Thanks.
I could have given you a few of my minutes. I'll try to be brief. First, I want to thank James and the Society of Environmental Journalists for inviting Westinghouse and giving me the opportunity to at least say a few words. I did not come today with any prepared remarks, but I do have a few things on the back of the envelope or the back of the napkin, and they're right here in front of me, that I'd like to mention. Relative to the nuclear industry. And I think there's a great cross-section of the industry here at this table today. And from my perspective, I think it's more from being from Westinghouse, it's what does the future look like in terms of technology, and what does the future look like in terms of being able to ensure a Fukushima-type event does not occur, or as David said, that there are no fourth Pow moons. So what's our part, and what are we doing today? But just to give you a little backdrop, I know that some people aren't quite sure what Westinghouse means today. Westinghouse, I'll just make it perfectly clear, does not manufacture microwaves and washing machines and dryers and telephones and elevators and subways. Westinghouse is solely invested and interested in nuclear technology only. That's all we do today. If anybody would like the rest of that story, you can chat with me afterwards. I'd be glad to give you the 20-year history of how we got to where we're at today. But we do just nuclear. We are a international company. Our headquarters is located in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or Cranberry Township, as it is formerly as our address. And we are about 15,000 strong today, focused solely on nuclear technology. My role at Westinghouse is I am the director of the Small Modular Reactor Program, and I think it's appropriate that we can talk for just a few minutes about that today, because the events that unfolded at Fukushima are having a direct impact on what our small modular reactor design is going to be. So a little bit of history for myself. I've been involved in the nuclear industry for 7 days shy of 40 years. I hope that I don't look like I've been around this industry that long, but it's been an awful long time. I saw my first reactor, I witnessed my first reactor scram in 1976, so that was quite a while ago. Nonetheless, I've served in the U.S. Navy's Nuclear Propulsion Program. I've worked in the commercial nuclear power business. I've worked in the defense cleanup business for the U.S. Department of Energy. I've been involved in used fuel disposition systems, advanced fuel cycle innovation. I was part of an impact analysis team evaluating the Fukushima Task Force results, and that was with Westinghouse. I've been involved in advanced reactor development programs. And in addition to leading the Small Modular Reactor Development Program for Westinghouse, I'm also the lead for Westinghouse to support the U.S. Department of Energy's integration of nuclear with variable generating sources, and which is a very interesting project that has just kicked off within the U.S. DOE here this last year formally. So March 11th, 2011, what the heck was Westinghouse doing when that happened? We were in the middle of construction of AP1000s, four of them in China. We had four plants in the U.S. Either going into construction or starting construction. And our first concern was whether or not the AP1000 would survive a similar event. So we immediately, realizing that the impacts could have an impact on the AP1000 and the design of that plant, we immediately conducted our own analysis to determine how would the AP1000 fare in a similar event if it were to occur in a location where an AP1000 were operating. And we went through that analysis. It was not a quick analysis. It was actually quite lengthy and quite detailed. And the end result was good news, is that the AP1000 would have fared as we plan for it to fare, and there would be no event. So where was the small modular reactor at the same time? And we were just beginning into our design phase of the small modular reactor when these events unfolded. And we realized that we would need to be informed by the impacts analysis from Fukushima and what would we need to change or what we need to include in our design to ensure that that plant would be equally safe and would perform as the USNRC or any other regulatory body would license it. So some of the things we've done, all of the items that Cynthia mentioned, station blackout, mitigating strategies, the spent fuel pool instrumentation requirements, severe accident capable hardened vents for containment, flex implementation or the ability to provide alternate cooling sources to the reactor. All of that has informed our design. All of those elements have been incorporated into our design as it exists today. So we obviously, I think very clearly, we've gone and looked at what have we learned, and we're implementing it in a new design. And our small modular reactor really is a bit of a blue sky blank piece of paper from a ground up design, rather than just taking an existing plant design and just making it a little smaller and changing it. We looked at what could we do across the entire spectrum of the plant to make a plant, I hate to use the word safer, because in my 40-year opinion, nuclear power is safe, but what could we do to increase the mitigated capabilities of a plant during an event? And RSMR will do that at the point we put it into the marketplace. And I want to go back. I think David touched on something with all of those numbers that he rattled off for us. And what I heard David saying is that there, what I didn't hear David saying is that the technology was wrong, that the equipment was wrong, that the systems were wrong, the pipes were wrong. What I heard without him saying it was there are management safety systems that are put in place, and are put in place because of regulatory requirements. And over time, those safety management systems can degrade or be allowed to degrade due to human nature and the way us human beings are implementing those programs. And a former coworker of mine, Mr. Hop Hallett, some of you may know Hop Hallett, he's an industry expert in terms of accident investigations and high hazardous operating facilities. And he's analyzed the Chernobyl accident, the Three Mile Island accident, the Bhopal chemical accident, Bay City, Texas explosion, Exxon Valdez, and a number of others. I believe that Hawk will also be evaluating independently the safety management systems that possibly failed that led us to where we're at with Fukushima. So the technology is good. We as the people that operate the plants and maintain the plants and manage the plants, that's where we need to be absolutely diligent in how we conduct our business. And I think if we do that, I think we'll all be in a better place in the future. So with that, I'll just reserve anything else I have to say in response to any questions you might have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I mean, the issue of sort of the safety culture and management is actually pretty key. I just wanted to go back to one thing that Dave mentioned. Now, in terms of the issues with these 52 one-year-plus outages and what that, you know, what that means, you know, in terms of not being able to deal with those sort of before they happen, in terms of, you know, possibly setting up the U.S. for another type of Fukushima event, I was just wondering if, you know, let's see, three of you could comment, including Steve, as well as Cynthia and maybe Robin. And then I also wanted to go back a bit to the near-term task force, and I'll follow on after that.
I'm always wondering about the sort of back-of-the-envelope math David does from time to time in these sorts of areas, because I don't know what's behind the numbers. But let's accept for a moment that you can come up with an effective... I don't, for example, TVA once shut down all their 11 plants for an extended period of time because they felt they didn't have the right training, the right attitude, just a safety culture. And it wasn't necessarily a problem with each one of those individual plants, and I'm sure that's embedded in those numbers. But, I mean, let's accept for a moment you do have this problem. Davis Besson. Davis Besson, if you recall, was discovering a big hole in the reactor head, the top of the reactor, that corroded to the point where the only thickness left to preventing a loss of coolant accident was the internal stainless steel liner that was not affected. There was a leaking control rod drive through the top of the reactor that leaked sodium. And the really bad part of that was the number of people from that plant that during outages walked by, saw the pile of kind of corroded material and said, nah, you know, not my problem. Major breakdown in safety culture, which is an extremely important one. I suspect, David, that a lot of that stuff you pointed to, the lack of maintenance at Calhoun or whatever the reasons were in fact safety culture issues. NRC has a big safety culture effort. INPO has a safety culture effort. So it's something we take very, 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 very seriously, and we learn from all these experiences. We write up operating experience reports. And I'm not trying to downplay all these things. I do think you have to be a little careful with the numbers, but it goes to safety culture, and Robin said about the equipment is fundamentally sound is the point. But of course, the weakness in the system is always people training. And in the large part, bringing us back to the Fukushima question, if you read the very interesting reports that came out of Japan over the last few years, very, very counter to what you would imagine Japanese culture would do. A lot of self-review basically said that. It became a people problem. We believed our talking points about safety and et cetera down the line. Well, we try not to have those breakdowns here. We have improvements in our safety culture, and of course we could always do better. So.
I'd like to just also
All right, thanks. I just wanted to add a perspective and some context around these shutdowns. These shutdowns, I want to emphasize, were not shutdowns because of accidents. The population was not at risk from these shutdowns, and it certainly was a business issue and costs and so forth that David mentioned. And that isn't our interest or our concern as a regulatory body. We're interested in safety, and for these plants in long-term shutdowns, we certainly have a very rigorous program in ensuring they're capable and ready for restart. So that's kind of the back end. But on the front end of it, and why these have led to these long shutdowns, is there are an accumulation of issues, some of which have been identified during the shutdown condition. But there are many indicators that the companies who operate these plants should be responding to. It's the responsibility of the company to identify the issues when they're small. Now, I have inspectors on site. Actually, I was an inspector on site myself for a number of years early in my career. And we are doing a sampling looking at things, but we also use thresholds. So just to remind you, we have a threshold that ensures public health and safety. The expectations for industry put on themselves is that they operate at a higher level. And I would offer that that's the level that really needs to be examined for ensuring plants don't get into long-term shutdowns. Now, that's not to say there weren't areas of significant interest for us in these various shutdowns. And then our role is certainly coming in ensuring those are rectified prior to restarting.
Oh, and then I guess if Robin, if you have any comments, and then I'll probably let Dave respond. And then actually just one comment. I know that I guess in the case of Fort Calhoun, it was actually the NRC that told them to raise their flood protection, which probably saved their hide, right?
Yeah, NRC inspectors identified that they weren't adequately maintaining their readiness for such a flood, and that they actually did put a lot of things in place that actually allowed them to ride out the flood in a much better state than it was. Again, there was no risk to the core, there was no risk to the population in that, but they weren't doing it correctly. The NRC did step in, and it provided for a better place for them to be to ride out the storm.
Yeah, it was just kind of, it was kind of strange coming so closely after Fukushima that there would be a water event like that. But anyway, Robin.
Could you refresh me? What was the topic again?
I guess regarding some of these longer-term outages and what they sort of mean and what they could, in terms of their potential problems.
Very good. Outage length. And again, I want to talk about the future. And in particular, the Westinghouse small modular reactors, we don't just design the plant and then let the operators just go operate it the best they can. Our design is informed primarily, if we should not say, with a single focus on safety, but also on, is this plant going to really fulfill the needs for the customer, the person who operates the plant? And outage length is very important in terms of profitability for the operator. So in terms of our design, we're informed with a 17-day outage goal for our small modular reactor, and that's from breaker to breaker. And obviously that doesn't address all the little tiny items that might be building up behind the curtain that don't quite warrant being fixed or warrant getting attention until an event happens. But nonetheless, the design is informed by minimizing outages. But we do it by minimizing the types of items that actually need to be maintained. And then for those that do need to be maintained, is the design is informed by the principle that is it possible to maintain them without even being in an outage or without it being on a critical path in the outage so that we can minimize the time the plant shut down. Because having been an operator for many, many years, the safest plant, in our opinion, as an operator, and this was our opinion, my opinion as an operator, was an operating plant, as we always love to have a plant operating at 100% power. And that's the way we like to keep them. So we intend to minimize that outage time from an original design perspective.
Okay. Dave, I think you answered.
Just a couple of quick rebuttal points. One on Davis Fessy. What troubled me most about Davis Fessy is when the NRC's Office of the Inspector General interviewed the senior managers who allowed Davis Fessy to continue running, The NRC staff had drafted an order that would have required that plant to shut down. They built a very strong circumstantial case, but the NRC senior managers set it aside. And when the inspector general interviewed them, the senior manager said, we need absolute proof that a plant is unsafe. Just a strong circumstantial case isn't enough. We need absolute proof that a plant is unsafe before we'll shut it down. You'll never build a stronger case that a plant is unsafe than the staff built at Davis-Besse, yet that didn't happen. So I hear Cindy, and I know it's sincere, but when it comes into practice, that's not what happens. As far as Fort Calhoun, the NRC formed a task force after Three Mile Island, after Chernobyl, after Fukushima, after Fort Calhoun, shut down for 30 months. The NRC did not form a task force to see what could we have seen this sooner? Could we have compelled the agency, the owner, to act sooner? That's apparently acceptable for all these problems to accumulate over decades. Why wasn't that studied by the agency for lessons learned on what we might be able to do next time to protect the future that Robin wants and I want also?
Well, to take up Cindy's view, it's not NRC's job to tell the industry how to run their internal business risks. That's our job. And we've looked at the OE's operating experiences from that plant. There's a lot of other flood issues at other sites. I mean, you talk about the main lesson from Fukushima. And, you know, I would just say this generally, not particularly any plant in mind. You exceed your seismic design capacity design by 10%. These plants are so robust, they'll just shake around a bit and you're okay. You exceed your flood design by 10% and you have a problem. Once that water starts coming over the wall, it keeps coming over the wall. And at Fukushima, the problem was, as David points out, I don't know whether you pointed out today, it was in your book, David, that the history of why the tsunami wall wasn't made higher, there was a lot of tsunami science that they seemed to ignore, and they have all kinds of explanations. Okay, the science was there. I think it's fair to say, Cindy, I look to you on this, is that the way Fukushima was built, the location it was in, they lowered the land 20 feet to reduce the pump head requirement from the ultimate heat sink, the ocean, into the condensers, was just asking for trouble. And granted, you didn't have the general design criteria you have now at the time, but if we had one of those designs in this country, now former former NRC Commissioner Magwood said in a vote sheet, we probably would have required massive changes or shut that plant down. That's not me. That's a commissioner of the NRC speaking, because, well, it's just sort of waiting to happen. And then, in addition to the water coming over the seawall, and I visited in September, you were there, been there a couple of times, you look to see where their diesel generators are, you could put them in a lower point in the plant. So, and with openings above for cooling. So you're like waiting for the water to come in. So these are the kinds of things, the kind of lessons that we've learned about what happens when you're dealing with floodwaters. So that's a very, very serious situation. But I can tell you that from the standpoint of business risk, these are the things we looked at very, very, very clearly. And again, going back to all the points that David raised about Fort Calhoun, yes, there's been a great lessons learned. I'm just not so sure it's an NRC thing, it's more than an industry thing, to tell you the truth.
Well, I mean, actually, I'd love to talk a bit more on safety, including some of the near-term task force issues, but we're a bit pressed for time. So I just wanted to go just a bit, just one question on sort of the economic case, and then go to questions to the audience. Now, in terms of the economic case, you've got the issue with LNG now being so cheap. It may not be cheap forever, and there are other issues with LNG and fracking, et cetera. And then also, if you look at the sort of the life cycle costs, I believe Steve said an operating nuclear plant, but I'm just wondering, if you look at the total life cycle costs versus, say, other sources of energy, I mean, how does nuclear compare? And then also now with cheap natural gas, the economic case or the business case, I guess, is failing for some utilities, I think, including Exelon in Illinois. I think there's some issue whether they might shut down some plants because of the economic case, and that's happened in some other plants as well. And so, I mean, one is the sort of the economic business case, and the other is I'm looking at sort of the life cycle costs of nuclear, including, you know, everything from fuel to sort of final fuel reprocessing or final disposal. And so I don't know if Steve and then Robin and then I guess if Dave could talk a bit about that. And And since we're a bit pressed for time, I hope you can just keep it fairly short.
Okay, 2 points. The plants that have shut down for economic reasons are in markets in the Midwest and in New England that do not value those aspects of large base generation, nuclear, coal, whatever, that provide to the grid. And we're only looking at the very short-term cost of fuel. Right now, natural gas, as you point out, is inexpensive. Having said that, nuclear energy is the only energy source that internalizes every cost going forward, including disposal, including insurance for major accidents and everything else. So you have that's incorporated where others don't. Lastly, the four plants that are being built right now have been looked at with a fine-tooth comb in both Georgia and South Carolina, and each one is competitive at natural gas, between $1.50 and $2, which is remarkable given where natural gas prices are today. So I think that's where we're kind of seeing the development occur.
I'll keep it quick. I think it's safe to say that the price of LNG is going to go up at some point in the future, probably after I retire. But nonetheless, Stephen really described quite well the complexities that are involved with determining actually the cost of nuclear. And I would just ask, I plead, I beg the economists and the financial analysts in the world to just compare the costs on a level playing field for everything, so that we as ratepayers and taxpayers can actually make a comparison, that we don't have to have years of academic study to understand how they came up with their numbers. So a level playing field, let's just do it the same for everything. The last thing I just want to add is, if you really want some good analysis into terms of cost of nuclear, then some of the latest information, Geoffrey Rothwell, retired from the University of Stanford, has just completed the most recent study on what is the closest to levelized cost of electricity for nuclear. In this case, it was in terms of small modular reactors, but he used a portfolio analysis approach, which I applaud him for, because that's the exact scenario in which we will build out new nuclear. It'll be part of a portfolio. It's not generally just, let's build one plant for one customer at one location and that's that. We're finding in today's marketplace they have multiple generating capabilities, whether it's coal, gas, geothermal, solar, or nuclear. So the portfolio analysis is a very good look. And I'd recommend everybody get a copy of Professor Rothwell's paper, and it's well worth the read.
Okay. I don't know, Dave, did you have any comments? Okay. I mean, one thing is, I've tried to look at this issue in terms of looking at the life cycle costs, and the numbers are just all over the place. And, whether does that include carbon? Does that include, in the case of Japan, the final disposal of the spent fuel? Because there were some questions about whether that had been properly allocated. And so it's really, I don't know, I have not been able to find a really good number looking at the life cycle costs of every source of fuel. And because they have all kinds of costs. But anyway, I'd like to open it up to the audience. First to SCJ members. Please. Mr. Henry?
Yeah. You want to just not leave the microphone, but I can.
Well, name and
affiliation.
Yeah, Tom Henry at the Toledo Blade. First, I wanted to ask Mr. Kraft and anyone else, you had characterized the Davis-Bessie accident as a safety culture breakdown, which is very clear, which the NRC had addressed. But you also said there were a number of workers who went by and said, nah, not my problem. I mean, first of all, the insulation wasn't removed for years. The NRC's Mel Holmberg had said during lessons learned that the reactor head had not been inspected for years like it should have been, and through video inspection, there was a guy named Andrew Samasco who tried to file for whistleblower protection, was denied, and was ultimately fired and indicted. In his termination letter, he was told he was being fired not for his oversight of the reactor head, which his attorney said he was never trained to do, but he was terminated because he insisted on getting reactor coolant pumps replaced, which had never been replaced in about a 30-year-old plant at the time, and they were supposed to be replaced every 15 years. So I was just wondering why you would characterize it as, nah, not my problem, and also to amplify, carry on a little bit with what Dave was saying, Sam Collins, who had made the decision for the NRC not to execute the shutdown order this is part of it, because I thought maybe people would want to respond to this too, but I'll finish real quickly. But Sam Collins had ultimately said in the transcript that I FOIA'd of the Inspector General interview, he said it ultimately came down to why he wasn't going to execute the shutdown order was, quote unquote, I trusted First Energy to do the right thing, and that was the same day he had met with First Energy executives. So I just wanted to see if you folks would, you know, revisit the way that was characterized.
Well, I can't comment on a given situation, a given employee. I mean, that's probably in a court someplace, or it was, so I'm not going to go there. But in terms of my characterization, it was more of a generalized sort of, you know, breakdown in the way I would characterize a breakdown in culture. I don't know one individual who said it's not my problem, but there were indications, I think, in the plant that there was a problem that needed to be looked at. I know the rest of the industry was pretty astounded when we learned what it was, and in fact, we formed a very large, very expensive materials program through the Electric Power Research Institute to look for these kinds of problems, to make sure that people weren't ignoring these problems, they were paying attention to them, and I think about 30 reactor vessel heads, don't quote me on 30, but a good number of pressurized water reactor vessel heads were changed out because of the materials program from the operating experience from Davis Bessey, as well as INPO and NRC getting more heavily involved in safety culture. So forgive me for being, you know.
Well, but also when First Energy paid a record $30 million fine and pled no contest to the allegations that the NRC brought against it, what does that say about the industry's responsibility for that incident?
I think the rest of the industry looks at that and says, we need to avoid a $30 million fine, so let's pay attention to the problem. That's the point of the fine, right? The point of the fine is, on the one hand, to penalize and take an action against the perpetrator, but it is also designed to send signals, and it has nothing to do with nuclear power. It's the reason you pay a fine when you have a tracker violation. It's to make you wake up and say, uh-oh, I don't want to do that again. But you tell your friends and your neighbors and everybody else, and says, well, really, they're writing tickets on that road? Not to be more careful on that road. That's kind of the purpose of it. Yeah, or avoid it altogether. But, you know, that's the point. Cindy, do you want to?
A couple of comments in this regard. One of the things, and it's one of the things I talk about with new operators as I give them their licenses, is the need to be vigilant on their conditions of what they're seeing in their facilities. And in the case of Davis Bessey, there were indications the air filters were in containment, were collecting material, rust-related material. So there were signs that weren't adequately addressed, and it was happening way too frequently and increasing in rapidity, and they weren't reacting. So there's an example where the safety culture certainly played into not reacting to the information that was available to them. A couple of other things that we learned a lot as well from the Davis Bessey event, both internally and what we did, and we changed some of our inspection programs. We created a whole set of indicators or assessment areas in the safety culture area. We also put additional requirements on the licensees to do increased inspections and change some of the behaviors in which they conducted their work. So there were learnings certainly from us in that regard. And regarding the shutdown order and the decision, we weren't in the region involved in that specifically, but I haven't read the transcripts that I think David has read, but I just want to, it was a decision to delay the shutdown of the reactor for the inspection. It wasn't a carte blanche allowing them to operate forever. So I just wanted to add that to the context.
To shut down 6 weeks earlier than when they were planning.
Right. It was to allow a delay versus allow an indefinite period of time. That was the only comment I wanted to make in that.
Okay. So a question from the gentleman in the purple shirt.
I'm Roger Witherspoon, out here, and thank everybody for being here. I have a question about, well, two actually. One dealing with oversight.
Oh, can you better have the microphone? I think they're recording.
I had a question about oversight in particular. While you have inspectors at all the plants, you have a policy basically against requiring retrofits, and some of the safety requirements that the NRC has come up with are delayed for years, if ever. For example, fire safety. Some of the requirements of fire safety stemming from the Browns Ferry fire 30 years ago now still haven't been implemented. And there are cumulative requirements that you have that don't get fully implemented. In the wake of Fukushima, that's what we're talking about, you suddenly had an emergency inspection at all plants looking at the severe accident mitigation assessments, which had not been looked at before. Have you decided since then that in the future you're not going to exempt certain safety systems from being examined to see if they're actually valid? And the second question is a bit different for Hannah. How does a reporter wade through something like this?
Oh, yeah, she gets a short question. I have a really long question. I have been around longer. Okay, fair enough.
And if you can maybe address some of the near-term task force. Well, maybe not.
Well, let me give a shot at it. First, starting with our inspectors, you're correct. We do have inspectors at our site. We've got full-time inspectors, and then we also have inspectors who visit from our regional offices to look at specialty areas. And you mentioned fire protection, so let me just touch on that briefly. There are a number of different ways in which fire protection can be accomplished, and that's really what we're looking for. We allow some flexibility in meeting an outcome. Our goal is protection of the public health and safety and safety. We don't always prescribe it must be done in this specific way. So there are different ways in which plants do attain that safety outcome. So fire protection is one way where you will see variation between facilities, some doing an older style regulatory model and some doing a newer style. So you will see variations. But we don't allow
variations. Companies do say, well, can we have an exemption or
extension? We do allow, under the appropriate circumstances, we do allow exceptions or exemptions. Our rules do allow for an assessment for meeting a safety outcome in a different way. And so, yes, we do allow exemptions at times, but those are rigorously reviewed by our experts, and so it's done very mindfully and very cautiously. And so we do ensure we have a regulatory foundation that attains safety throughout.
Thanks for the question, Roger. First of all, I'd say from the national perspective, or, you know, kind of being in Washington, D.C., how you cover this issue is you hound the chairman. You know, former NRC chairman Greg Yatsko always called attention to this issue. He wanted more done. And I wrote a lot about that at the time. What you do is you keep an eye on it. I asked NRC Chairman Allison McFarland about this just recently. I guess on the regional level, what you do is look at exactly what can happen to your plant. Where are the, you know, I'm probably called experts in the field and ask them, how does this relate to my plant? What are the exemptions, you know, for my facility? I guess that's, you know, how I would see it.
Dave, did you have any comments?
Okay,
the gentleman here, and then
Mike.
Well,
I'm Don Corrigan. I'm with Times Newspapers in St. Louis. A story was in the Post-Dispatch in St. Louis, another media small story, about that they were looking at train transportation of nuclear waste again. And my communities in my area were particularly upset with the Three Mile Island nuclear transports, which was viewed in some sectors as sort of a pilot for what was going to happen in the future. My questions are, and whoever wants to take them or comment on them. This train transport, does this mean that the dry cask storage that's on site now, they are looking at trying to figure out how to transport this stuff? And is there a new Yucca Mountain being considered, or is Yucca Mountain still a possibility? And finally, I know this is exhaustive, but these smaller modular nuclear reactors that Westinghouse is planning, is that something that's going to require this kind of transport as well when it comes to the fuel rods?
Sorry, we're going to have to, I guess, pretty much cut this short because you've got the plenary session.
Okay, real quick. Yes, at some point, what's in spent fuel pools will be moved to dry casks. Dry casks will either be transportable or they will be then loaded into transport casks. Will have to be moved to a federal facility. Will there be another Yucca Mountain? Is Yucca Mountain still alive? You're talking about something that's sort of mixed into the national fabric, you know, political debate. And all I can tell you is that NRC walked away from the evaluation of the Yucca Mountain site. The court just ruled that was an illegal action. They have to restart it. We expect them to do so. There has been legislation introduced in Congress to attempt to restart the program, find a central storage facility. So, yeah, there will be something at some point, and yes, transportation has to occur. But all the statistics and all the experience, now I remember the Three Mile Island transport, and we stopped the train at some point, and we went through a safety discussion, and then we were able, and we satisfied the community. We were able to move the train. Very good experience. Other transports have occurred with exactly the same kind of result. Transports in Europe are routine with no problems, so we rely on a lot of that evidence. So I think in the long run you're going to see that, but there will be a time of restart of this, but it's not going to happen immediately.
I'd like to just add to that, the responsibility for a repository, Yucca or anything else, is not the responsibility of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's the administration and the Department of Energy's responsibility. Yes, we did cease reviewing the application for Yucca Mountain after the Department of Energy said they no longer wanted it reviewed and actually wanted it withdrawn. The NRC did stop our review. We had a small amount of money left to do that Congress had given us, and we did reinstitute our review of that and our spending down that money. But in the big scheme of things, Department of Energy, the owner and the responsible party, asked us to stop. So I just wanted to make sure there was some context on who's our role is to do a safety review, but right now I think you have to question the Department of Energy and their long-term expectation and long-term plan.
Oh, you have a quick comment.
I'm just going to quickly add to that, that it's also obviously an issue for Capitol Hill right now, and members of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee are talking about legislation to move something forward with a repository. They're running into opposition from House Republicans who want Yucca Mountain. So it's, you know, action on Capitol Hill is completely stalled, although we've had discussions about, oh, maybe there's optimism out there. So just to add that broader context.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We've run out of time, and the people that are want to go to the plenary or keynote address, I guess, with Interior Secretary Sally Jewell, that starts at 3:15. But I think our speakers will probably have a bit of time to chat afterwards. I know there are, I think, some more questions and probably some more specific questions that will be directed towards them. But I'd like to thank our speakers today. Thank you very much.